the trials that I've been to, it's been almost sometimes humorous how quickly the jury comes back with a guilty verdict.
An expert weighs in on the trial of a Fairbanks militia leader. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, May 8th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the author of a new book on ExxonMobil gives his take on how company executives view Alaska.
They regard Alaska as a place that they just can't seem to figure out politically.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Alaska Housing Finance Corporation offers competitive interest rates with programs tailored for first-time home buyers and home choice seminars that cover the details of purchasing and financing a home. There's more information at ahfc.us. This message sponsored by Alaska Housing Finance Corporation.
Portrayals of peacemakers, militia members as dangerous men plotting to kill federal employees were juxtaposed with characterizations of the men as hapless big mouths who exaggerated a lot but were harmless during this morning's opening statements in day two of the Schaefer Cox, Lonnie Vernon, and Barney Coleman federal trial in Anchorage. Prosecutor Yvonne Lamoureux said peacemakers leader Schaefer Cox believed federal agents were plotting to kill his family and take down the militia. She described a dry erase board seized from his home that detailed plans for killing federal agents. She quoted Cox as saying to a state trooper, "We have you outmanned, outgunned, and can have you dead in one night." Lamoureux said prosecutors have 100 hours of recordings and plan to call 70 witnesses and introduce 700 pieces of evidence. Defense attorney Nelson Traverso, representing Cox, said testimony would show Cox was not attempting to overthrow the government, but instead was simply an agitator for civil liberties, a father of two who believed the government would collapse and the militia had to be prepared to defend people. Traverso said Cox's statement to the trooper was distasteful, but within his right to free speech. Coleman Barney's attorney Timothy Dooley said Barney was a Mormon, married with five children, and a successful electrical business. He said he didn't have murder, but rather protection in mind. He said the federal government was overreaching. Attorney M.J. Hayden said her client, Lonnie Vernon, just had poor taste in the people he hung out with. She said a conspiracy is an agreement, and there wasn't one in place to buy weapons or commit murder. The men consider themselves sovereign citizens above state and federal law. Washington, D.C.-based writer J.J. McNabb is working on a book about the sovereign citizens movement and tracks court cases involving them across the country. McNabb says the difference between ideas and actions is always central.
If you're daydreaming about having, you know, some kind of a revolution, that's one thing, but actually plotting to engage in a revolution is something different.
Schaefer Cox was facing a weapons charge and Lonnie Vernon owed back federal taxes when they and fellow militia member Coleman Barney supposedly hatched a plan to retaliate against court and law enforcement officials. They were arrested in March 2011, charged with planning violence and stockpiling illegal weapons to carry it out. McNabb says militia defendants tend not to fare well in court.
To be fair, it's not all that difficult to convict these groups. The trials that I've been to, it's been almost sometimes humorous how quickly the jury comes back with a guilty verdict.
McNabb says federal prosecutors pursue cases that are easiest to win, and the Fairbanks militia case is interesting because none of the men have pleaded guilty.
Generally, the government is very good at offering the weakest link very good deals. For example, there's a parallel case going on right now in Georgia. Four gentlemen plotted against the U.S. government in a three-prong attack. Theirs was a little more explicit in terms of what the attack would be. And two of the defendants have already pled guilty.
The Fairbanks militia case has gotten a lot of press, but McNabb says the most damaging evidence against the accused has likely been held for the courtroom.
We have to understand that most of the really egregious stuff we haven't seen yet because the prosecutors generally save the worst for the trial. And it's not something that the defense attorneys would have paid attention to, and you know they probably hope that the prosecution won't bring that stuff up. But in all of the cases I've attended, there's always been some kind of smoking gun or some kind of big event or big conversation that people outside, you know, people outside the courtroom haven't heard before.
The government's case is built on recordings made by informants who infiltrated the group, and McNabb says that can be contentious.
Because informants, you know, may add to the story rather than just report. And that usually comes out during trial.
McNabb says she's keeping special eye on the Fairbanks militia case because Schaefer Cox has charisma that could make him a leader of the broader sovereign citizens movement. She says the movement is in the midst of its latest outgrowth, with an estimated 300,000 adherents in the U.S., a blossoming that encompasses a broad spectrum of people angry with government. The trial continues tomorrow. Lawmakers held their first meeting in Washington, D.C. today to decide how to pay for the nation's roads, bridges, and highways for the next few years. As APRN's Peter Granitz reports, money for tribal roads could increase, but some fear the money won't be distributed equally to the state's tribes.
The group of 34 lawmakers patching together the House and Senate versions of a highway bill is a virtual who's who of committee leaders and Capitol Hill veterans. Don Young is one of them. The former chair of the Transportation Committee says the version that passed to the Senate uses a new formula for doling out money to tribes for roads. And that new equation helps the 10 largest tribes in Alaska more than the others, because it puts an emphasis on population and the amount of existing lanes. He says that misses the point, which is to get more money to the more remote areas
that are not accessible to any type of transportation at all, and try to make that more saleable, like in the Kuskokwim area that Bethel does quite well. But in reality, though, the villages outside of Bethel aren't eligible for the money they were in the old formula.
Young is critical of Alaska's senators who voted for that chamber's version of the bill. Senator Lisa Murkowski calls the bill a mixed bag. The state could land hundreds of millions of dollars for all sorts of infrastructure projects, but she says tribal governments that have been included in money discussions for a long time no longer are.
I'm not satisfied with what we've ended up with, but I do recognize that we were successful in beefing up the funding, so it was kind of, I guess I'm looking at it as a partial win.
It's unclear whether the conference committee will actually meld the bills and have Congress vote on it. It could just pass an extension of the current plan, as it has in the past. For his part, Young says he'd rather pass an extension instead of a bad bill. At the end of an interview in his office, he laid back in his chair and simply said, "That's just my prerogative. I'm not the chairman anymore." Maybe, though, all those years with the gavel will come in handy. In Washington, D.C., I'm Peter Granitz.
Governor Sean Parnell last week signed a bill setting standards that allow naturally occurring asbestos to be extracted and used in construction projects around the state. It also protects owners of contaminated gravel, construction companies, landowners, workers, and communities from any legal responsibility if health hazards develop. APRN's Dave Donaldson reports.
The bill's sponsor, Kotzebue Democrat Reggie Jewell, says the need for the exemption came from the Upper Kobuk area, Ambler in particular, where there's been no construction, no roads, not even an expansion of the sewage lagoon since the state began enforcing federal workplace safety standards in 2003. Jewell says the area has a very high concentration of asbestos that becomes airborne when it is disturbed.
The community recognized that they were in a catch-22. They would never get their water and sewer issues. They wouldn't get their runway improved. They wouldn't build new homes unless we had a way to recognize and regulate what we were dealing with. And this allows that to occur.
The new law considers any gravel containing, by volume, 24% or less asbestos to be safe. To use material containing more than that level, the project manager must develop a site-specific safety and handling plan. Beyond those requirements, the legal immunity goes into place, with no recourse for those who might get cancer or pulmonary diseases caused by asbestos poisoning, such as mesothelioma. Senate Judiciary Chair Hollis French says that a plan is not enough when gravel and asbestos are underfoot, where children are playing, or when an added protective material begins to wear off. His committee had written a limit to the legal immunity issue, but that was removed before the bill was passed. He voted against the measure.
I don't believe in blanket immunity because people get very, very sick from asbestos, and there's no safe threshold of asbestos. And while that community needs development, there is a way to do it completely safely, which is to cap it with asphalt. And I'm not sure they're going to do that.
In debate on the Senate floor on the final day of this year's regular session, Gallivan Democrat Donnie Olson, a physician, said Jewell's bill was a compromise between the needs of the community and the health of the citizens. He pointed to the different types of asbestos that occur.
The asbestos that causes mesothelioma comes from processed asbestos that is out there. I agree that mesothelioma is a terrible disease to have. It results in many negative aspects, some of which are somewhat fatal. And I'm just as opposed to having mesothelioma as anybody.
The bill took effect immediately when the governor signed it last week. This year's capital projects budget includes $3 million for school renovation of the Kobuk School and $4 million for work to be done on the Ambler Mining District Road. I'm Dave Donaldson in Juneau.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Ocean Beauty assesses the damage to their dock from the ferry Matanuska.
We don't know the full extent of the damage, and we might not for a few days.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Crowley, providing tanker escorts, fuel delivery, and energy support services to Alaskans for nearly 60 years. From Valdez to the North Slope, Crowley knows Alaska. CrowleyAlaska.com. And by Primera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska, providing quality health plans to companies and individuals in Alaska for over 60 years. More at Primera.com. Primera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska. We know the territory.
Searchers found a missing teenage girl on Prince of Wales Island today. 13-year-old Michaela McRoberts was apparently uninjured. Alaska State Troopers spokesperson Megan Peters got word shortly after noon.
The Alaska State Troopers were notified by ground searchers at approximately 12:02 that they had located Ms. Roberts. According to searchers on scene, she did not appear to have any injuries, and she was not reporting to them that she was injured. She's in the process of being transported out of the search area, and depending on medical evaluation, she may be left in police protection or she may be transported on to receive treatment if she has anything that needs to be addressed.
McRoberts' family reported her missing the evening of Sunday, May 6th, after she had not returned from a hike on a trail near the end of Port Protection Road. Troopers said she was fairly new to Alaska and not very familiar with the area. According to Peters, the search included 41 people on the ground, along with four search and rescue dog teams, a Coast Guard helicopter, and four skiffs. Along with state troopers and the Coast Guard, the effort involved volunteers from the Ketchikan and Klawak rescue squads, as well as Sitka Mountain Rescue and Port Protection residents. Port Protection is a remote fishing town that is home to about 53 people on northwest Prince of Wales Island. Anchorage police now believe an airman missing for 3 weeks was the victim of foul play. Police spokesman Lieutenant Dave Parker says detectives are releasing little information about what led them to that conclusion today. Parker adds that the missing Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson airman, Clinton Reeves, appears to be an innocent victim. Reeves was last heard from on April 22nd. An Alaska-based soldier from California has been killed in Afghanistan. U.S. Army Alaska says in a release that 30-year-old Staff Sergeant Thomas Kent Fogarty of Alameda, California, died Sunday when the vehicle he was commanding hit a roadside bomb. The Army says three other soldiers were wounded in the incident in Ahmad Kiel, Afghanistan. All four are assigned to Fort Richardson. Alaska State Troopers and Fairbanks Police are on the lookout for two men who walked away from a privately operated halfway house in Esther over the past 10 days. The state corrections official who oversees the North Star Community Residential Center and seven other facilities says the public has little to fear from the escapees, who are serving time for lesser offenses. But a Fairbanks Police spokesman says the escapees divert officers from more serious cases. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
State Probation Parole Program Director Billy Hauser says the two men who escaped from the North Star Center don't present a danger to the community. That's because they and the 132 other residents of the halfway house are mainly lesser criminals, most of whom commit offenses involving substance abuse.
Typically, the folks that you're going to see in these halfway houses aren't what you would consider high-risk offenders. They're more dangerous to themselves, for the most part, because of their substance abuse issues than they are to people in the community.
Hauser oversees the state program that contracts the three private corrections company that operate eight halfway houses around Alaska. And he says escapes do happen because the facility's security staff members aren't trained professional corrections officers, so they have limited authority to stop escapes.
Security staff are only responsible for basically monitoring who comes in, who goes out. If a person wants to leave a halfway house, they are not to lay hands on them.
Hauser says five North Star residents have escaped since early last year when the state awarded a contract to GeoCare to operate the facility and five others around the state. GeoCare is by far the biggest of the three corrections companies operating in Alaska. It's a subsidiary of Florida-based multinational Geo Group. In August 2010, Geo merged with the Cornell Companies, the previous contractor at North Star, and its other facilities in Alaska, three in Anchorage, one in Bethel, and one in Nome. The State Corrections Department paid GEO $3.7 million for the first of a five-year option contract to operate North Star. Critics of private corrections companies say their tendency to minimize personnel and salaries simply shifts costs elsewhere, especially to law enforcement agencies. Fairbanks Police Lieutenant Dan Wellborn concedes that North Star's escapees aren't dangerous, but rounding them up can divert officers from keeping an eye on those who are.
It does take a bit of a toll on our resources as well, because if we get a report of a walkaway, then, of course, the officers are out there now diverting their attention from, say, an assault call or higher priority call.
In Fairbanks, I'm Tim Ellis.
Ocean Beauty Seafood still plans to run its Petersburg plant this summer, despite this week's ferry accident. According to Vice President of Marketing Tom Sunderland, the company hopes to make repairs in time for summer or find a way to work around the damage.
We don't know the full extent of the damage, and we might not for a few days. But we've already discussed, at least the plant managers have among themselves, discussed some potential workarounds for what to do in case some portion of the dock is not usable. They're still going to be able to operate.
The Alaska Marine Highway and the Coast Guard are investigating what caused the 408-foot ferry Matanuska to crash bow first into the Ocean Beauty dock early Monday afternoon. According to a state spokesperson, the southbound vessel had been maneuvering for its approach to the ferry terminal at the time. There was a strong incoming tide at its stern. No one was injured, but the impact smashed in a significant section of the wood and concrete dock, as well as the face of the processing plant. One of the company's cranes fell most of the way through the damaged dock, where debris hung loose above broken pilings. Marine Highway officials offered apologies to Ocean Beauty in a news release today and credited the Matanuska's crew members for taking proper action after the accident. They said they found no significant damage to the vessel.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
the Pebble Partnership, developing a comprehensive mine plan that meets Alaska's regulatory requirements while supporting sustainable fisheries in Southwest Alaska. PebblePartnership.com. Home, it's where you lay your head, eat home-cooked meals, and gather with friends. Home is where you grew up and learned about life. Alaska is home, and when you choose to violate someone by committing sexual assault, you harm them, and you harm yourself, your friends, your family, your home, and Alaska. No one deserves to be sexually assaulted, so make the right choice. Real Alaskans choose respect. This message brought to you by the Alaska Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault.
The former executive director of the Alaska Eskimo Whaling Commission has pleaded guilty to two counts of theft and misapplication of $475,000 in commission money. Maggie Amawak entered the plea Monday before U.S. District Court Judge Sharon Gleason in Anchorage. The 62-year-old Amawak was head of the commission from 1990 to April 2007. Her husband, George Amawak Sr., was elected North Slope Borough Mayor five times, but lost a re-election bid 12 days after she was indicted. Federal prosecutors say Amawak paid bills for plane tickets, groceries, and doctors with money she misappropriated. They say she paid for gambling trips with a family member, bought three snow machines, and made a down payment on a Hummer. Amawak is scheduled to be sentenced July 23rd. Two of Alaska's three major oil and gas producers are highly visible, but the third is not. While BP and ConocoPhillips have large office buildings in Anchorage, ExxonMobil's Alaska operations are run from an anonymous suite of offices in a midtown building that has no sign bearing the company's name. The sign was taken down 23 years ago for security reasons when protests erupted there following the Exxon Valdez oil spill. It was never replaced. The author of a new book about the company does not find that surprising at all. New Yorker writer Steve Call says the corporate culture within ExxonMobil is all about minimizing risk and steadily making money. The book, Private Empire, ExxonMobil and American Power, opens with an account of the Alaska oil spill, which made the company the most hated in the nation, but Call says also one of the most safety-oriented. Call paints a portrait of a company in which everything is done by the book and everybody plays by the same rules, a regimented company in which control is paramount. And he says that control mania is probably why ExxonMobil has been reluctant to do business in Alaska.
I did try to understand their attitude, ExxonMobil's attitude towards Alaska at different points, and the gas piece of it was probably the most important thing. You know, ExxonMobil sort of has this attitude that they want low political risk and high political stability. That suits their very, you know, very rigid long-term business model. And they regard Alaska as a place that they just can't seem to figure out politically. And they often talk about Alaska the way they talk about, you know, other political environments that they just can't seem to manage.
Call says even though ExxonMobil's current chairman, Rex Tillerson, is cut from pretty much the same cloth as his predecessor, Lee Raymond, the company has begun to change. It no longer opposes a carbon tax, for instance, as a way to deal with climate warming. Also under Tillerson, Exxon is increasingly emphasizing natural gas as well as crude oil. Gas accounts for about half of its recoverable reserves. At the end of March, the company was able to add substantially to its gas reserves when it quietly bought out Chevron's 25% share of the undeveloped Point Thompson field on the North Slope. 2 days after closing that deal, ExxonMobil settled a long-running dispute with the state of Alaska over whether its development plan for Point Thompson was moving ahead fast enough to prevent the state from taking the leases back. ExxonMobil can now add 200 million barrels of natural gas condensate to its reserves, liquids it hopes to produce. It can also add 8 trillion cubic feet of gas that may get to market sometime in the future. Call's book is full of examples of how important it is to ExxonMobil to be able to book new reserves to replace what it produces, but he says it's questionable whether Point Thompson should count.
Yeah, I mean, their lawyers advised them about this, and basically the answer has to do with very detailed Securities and Exchange Commission rules, which are then interpreted kind of back and forth between the company lawyers and the commission lawyers as to exactly how ExxonMobil is making its decisions this way. I think the corporation basically has room to decide for itself what it wishes to declare as booked, but the SEC rules say that a holding has to be economically viable in some way. I forget exactly the language, but it has to be plausible commercially in a finite period of time. And so the absence of a distribution system is a factor in whether or not you can book something. If you really can't sell it, then you can't book it.
the point, Thompson Gas is still considered stranded because there is no pipeline to deliver it to market. But the fact that it is there and ready to be developed makes a big gas line a more attractive investment. Steve Call appeared on public radio call-in program Talk of Alaska this morning. Bethel Native Corporation had big news for its shareholders over the weekend when it announced it will partner with Omni Corporation to build a brand new Swanson's grocery store and a two-screen movie theater in Bethel. For the city and surrounding villages, the prospect of seeing a blockbuster on the big screen will be well worth the wait. From member station KYUK in Bethel, Mark Earhart has the story.
All that can be heard on this stretch of Chief Eddie Hoffman Highway is cars rushing past and a few stray plastic bags rustling in the wind. In a couple of years, that all could change. The cars might be replaced by shopping carts and the plastic bags by popcorn being munched. BNC is partnering with Omni Corporation, the company that owns Swanson's in Bethel, on a project that will undoubtedly garner a lot of attention in the near future.
Project Kipusvik, which will be a store and theater building located along Chief Eddie Hoffman Highway in between the new YK Admin Building and the Crowley Tank Farm area.
That's Anna Hoffman, president and CEO of BNC, who announced the new project to shareholders over the weekend.
One side of the building will be a 40,000 square foot store operated by Omni.
Hoffman says the new store would likely replace Omni's current grocery store. Swanson's located on the riverfront near downtown. The other Swanson stores, she says, which include the power sports shop and the hardware store, would remain in their current locations. But possibly the most intriguing part about the new plan would be the other side of the building.
Also in that building, we will have a two-screen theater operated by BNC.
Hoffman says she thinks that Bethel is the right size for a theater project.
Well, movie theater is something that's been talked about in Bethel for probably a decade.
The project will be built by BNC's construction subsidiaries and is to be located on BNC-owned land, Hoffman says.
You know, it's going to be a state-of-the-art construction, so it's going to have a very new feel, welcoming, and it should be comfortable and attractive to the people that come out and shop.
She says the company is finishing up soil sampling and will have to get the project approved by the city. But if all goes well, Hoffman says construction materials should arrive on the last barge of the season. Construction is planned to be completed by the summer of 2014. I'm Mark Earhart.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Matt Lichtenstein in Petersburg, Tim Ellis in Delta, and Mark Earhart in Bethel. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau, Steve Heimel from Anchorage, and Peter Granitz from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Kristen Spack. Josh Edge is our web producer, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
First National Bank Alaska, helping Alaska's dreams grow since 1922. On the web at fnbalaska.com, an equal housing lender, member FDIC. Northern Air Cargo. Since 1956, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come.
And by
Grant Station, your fast track to funding, helping identify appropriate grant makers for your organization's programs and projects. On the web at grantstation.com.
The APRN Speaker Series presents NPR's foreign correspondent Corey Flintoff Thursday, May 24th at the Anchorage Museum. While his career has taken him to over 45 countries, Flintoff got his start here in Alaska with the Alaska Public Radio Network as a producer and host of Alaska News Nightly. Hear from Corey Flintoff. Reservations and information for the 7 p.m. lecture and for the 6 p.m. meet and greet at alaskapublic.org. Proceeds benefit the Alaska Public Radio Network.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.